All right, John chapter 4, verse 1. Now Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that he was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John the Baptist, although in fact it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. So he left Judea and he went back once more to Galilee. Jesus had to go through Samaria. This is a very interesting line. Why did he have to go? He must go straight through Samaria, from Judea north into Galilee. Well, if you look at this on a map, as the crow flies, this would make the perfect sense, wouldn't it? To go from Jerusalem, you have to go through Samaria. Which other way would you go? However, Samaria is just a terrible place. To a Galilean or a Judean, a Jew, you would not want to go into Samaria. Let's look at some of the cultural, historical background of the relationship between the Jews and the Samaritans. This was a political, religious hotbed. Just to begin, in the 8th century, the Assyrians entered into northern Israel, and they interbred with the Israelites. They produced these half-breeds, half Assyrian, half Israelite. What are they? You know, history hasn't been quite kind to mixed people. And so they were called the Samaritans. They weren't Jews. They weren't Assyrians. It's kind of like that book series, Harry Potter. You know, you got muggles and witches. You know what I mean? And the middle ones, you remember what they're called? Mudbloods. Brought a little movie here for us.
No one asked your opinion, you filthy little mudblood. You'll be next, mudbloods. Filthy little mudblood.
Man, if you played a drinking game and every time what's-his-face called Hermione a mudblood, you'd have like 3 drinks. It'd be a normal amount of drinks. Anyways, so think about, you know, racism today. You read To Kill a Mockingbird. One of the worst things in that book, Harper Lee, points out, if you're black or white, that was one thing. You had a community. But if you were mixed back in the 1930s or whenever it was written, that was you were neither one nor the other. That was the Samaritans. They weren't Assyrian. They weren't Jewish. What are they? Samaritan. Nobody liked them. No one wanted to be around them. So they built their own religious, political little institution. They built their own temple, a separate temple, on Mount Gerizim, not on Mount Zion, where it should be according to 2 Chronicles chapter 3. That's where you build the real temple. They built their own temple. This goes back as far as Alexander the Great in the 4th century BC. Eventually, after 200 years of this pseudo-false temple to the Samaritans, John Hyrcanus, who was the high priest, led a group into Samaria, and they burned this fake temple to the ground. They just came in and just destroyed it. So this heightened the tension between the Samaritans and the Jews. And this turned into just terrible blood feuds. You kill one of ours, we kill one of yours. Put one of ours in the hospital, we put one of yours in the morgue. As the saying goes. One example is the Galileans were traveling through a Samaritan city. And the Samaritan, just out of the blue, comes out and kills one of the Galileans. Jesus is a Galilean. Jesus of Galilee. These are his people. So the Samaritans, just out of nowhere, kill one of these Galileans. And Josephus says, as a consequence, quote, a vast number of people ran together out of Galilee in order to fight with the Samaritans. So as soon as they saw this one guy get killed, the Galileans, picture like a baseball game. They just leave the dugout. They just start swinging. Later we read that the Jews in Jerusalem, so those are the Galileans, the Jews in the south, came out and slew these Samaritans without sparing any age, and they set these Samaritan villages on fire. Oh, this was bad. This was really bad. This led to total antipathy, hatred between these two groups. I mean, you think racism is bad today or in our country? Nothing compared to what we see here. Horrible. In extra-biblical literature, this isn't from the Bible, but this is Jewish literature outside of the Bible. We read this, there will be two manner of nations which my heart abhors, And the third is no nation. They that sit upon the mountain of Samaria and they that dwell among the Philistines and that foolish people that dwell in Shechem. That's one of these Samaritan cities. Shechem is the city of fools derided by all men. May I never set eyes on a Samaritan, says the Mishnah. May I never be thrown into company with him. They didn't even want to look at these people. That's how much hatred and vitriol they held in their hearts toward one another. And they were just writing about this openly. I mean, if you wrote something like this about a religion, a certain race, today you'd be canceled. You can't write that. Back then, this was just par for the course. This was considered normal, that you just hate Samaritans. Everybody hates them. Another part of the Mishnah says, the daughters of these Samaritans are regarded as menstruants from their cradle. In Jewish theology, you were considered unclean if you're going through your monthly cycle. So they're unclean from the moment they were born. That's what they're saying. The Samaritans did not welcome Jesus because he was on his way to Jerusalem. So even in the New Testament, we see this. Where in the New Testament, we see the Samaritans are like, Jesus of where? Galilee? No, we're not going to let him in here. When Jesus' two main guys, the sons of thunder is what their nicknames were, James and John, they saw the Samaritans do this. They said, Lord, should we call down fire from heaven to burn them up? And Jesus is like, no, don't do that. Don't burn. No, I didn't even know the disciples could do that. Apparently they're just praying. Hopefully we can pray and just have these Samaritans, just nuke them all. Let God sort them out. That was their attitude. And Jesus rebuked them sternly. Don't kill the Samaritans. No killing. Jesus' enemies in John 8, we're going to get there in a few weeks, maybe months. The enemies of Jesus were trying to insult him. And this is what they said. They said, aren't we right in saying that you are a Samaritan and demon-possessed? You see what they're saying? Which is worse, to be demon-possessed or to be a Samaritan? They're both terrible. Awful. So the hatred here was just thick. And the Samaritans couldn't even come over and believe in the God of Israel. They couldn't convert to Judaism. They had no share in the resurrection of the dead. If you were a Samaritan, you were sunk. You're going to hell. That's it. There's just so much hatred between the two groups. So if you were any self-respecting rabbi, you would go the long way around. I mean, not only would you do this because it makes sense geographically, you know, topographically, going through the mountains of Gerizim and Ebal, but it makes sense just to take the Jordan. Everybody takes the Jordan. You go around the Jordan. You don't go through Samaria as a Galilean or a Judean. You don't do that. That's walking into the wrong neighborhood. You don't go into Samaritan territory unless you're Jesus. And you go right into Sychar because you had to go through Samaria. Why? Why is it that he had to go there? He came to a town in Samaria called Sychar near the plot of ground that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, still there today. They built this big gaudy church over it. It's terrible. But the well has been there for thousands of years. Jesus was tired from the journey and he sat down by the well. And it was about noon. He has just hiked 40 miles through various terrain. And he makes it into the heart of Samaria, the city of Shechem. He sits down. It's high noon. It's hot. It's in Israel. So you imagine if you're in that place at that time in Jesus' shoes, you'd be thinking one thing, right? Water. Give me water. Finally, to come upon a well and just sit down by that well. Oh, I could just kill for it. Any of that water that's beneath the ground would be nice and cool. And all of a sudden, Jesus starts to think about this. And he sees sort of a metaphor, if you will, for something that he wants to teach. That same feeling that you get when you don't drink, when you're hiking, when you're sweating, you're thirsty. That's all you can think about. Constantly coming to your mind, thirsty, thirst, water. And Jesus sees this and he starts to think about that. At that moment, a Samaritan woman, both of these things are in the wrong, Samaritan and a woman, came to draw the water, and Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" Whoa. Rabbis don't talk to women. Jews don't talk to women. If you're a Jewish man, you don't talk to a woman in public. You don't do that. This included your wife. You don't talk to your wife in public. This included your sister. This included your very own daughter. Because it was considered a social faux pas, because we might not know if your daughter is actually your mistress or some woman that you're trying to hit on, something like that. So Jewish men wouldn't talk to women unless it was strictly business. I mean, it had to be strictly business. This was even grounds for divorce, according to extra-biblical literature. Again, this isn't in the Bible. This is outside the Bible and the traditions of people where they believe that, you know, you just don't do that. You don't talk to women. And even if you were to talk to a woman, you would not talk to a Samaritan woman. Oh, this is just so odious. I mean, if you're reading this as a first century reader, you'd just be going, oh, a rabbi talking to a Samaritan woman. And it's by a well. These were the social places in the ancient world. Like today, maybe you go out to a bar to meet a woman. You know, can I buy you a drink? Something like that. In the ancient days, you picked up a woman by the well. I don't know what the pickup lines would have been like back then. You know, and I'm not going to try any, in case you're wondering. But I like your bucket. I don't know. No. All right. Anyways, Isaac, he met his wife by a well. His servant went out and found his wife, Rebecca. Jacob just went up and smooched Rachel by a well. Moses met Zipporah by a well. And now Jesus is by a Samaritan woman by a well. And he's talking to her. The woman was surprised, for the Jews refused to have anything to do with Samaritans. Yeah, no kidding. She said to Jesus, you're a Jew. And Jesus is like, yeah. And she said, I'm a Samaritan woman. And Jesus is like, yeah, you are. Why are you asking me for a drink? 2 and 2 make 4. You don't do that. You're a Jew. I'm a Samaritan. You're a man. I'm a woman. You're a rabbi. I'm not a rabbi. Jesus answered her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. You see the reversal there? Would you give me a drink of water? And now he's saying, actually, if you knew who it was who was speaking to you, you'd be asking me for a drink of water. Sir, the woman said, you have nothing to draw with and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? So she's taking him very literalistically. He's speaking not in a literalistic fashion, unless maybe she thought that living water was like running water, not like putrid, stagnant water. Where can you get water? You can't offer me anything. Maybe she's being sarcastic, maybe cynical, maybe defensive, you know? Why are you talking to me? Are you trying to take something from me? Are you trying to, what's your motive here? Anyway, she's firing back here. Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his livestock? Jesus answered, everyone who drinks this water, they're going to be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water that I give will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life. Lady, I'm talking about different sort of water here. This is something way different than what you're talking about. You're giving me water that would help for a moment. I'm saying I've got water, metaphorically, that could help for eternity. The woman said to him, well, then give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and I have to keep coming down here to draw water. Yeah, I guess if you got that, why don't you just give it up? Jesus told her, go call your husband and come back. What's the relationship between verse 15 and verse 16? I know it's okay to change the subject at certain times, you know what I mean? But at this point, it's like, yeah, go give me the water. And Jesus says, no, you go get me your husband. That seems like a non sequitur. Like Jesus is changing the subject. No, he's not changing the subject at all. He's staying directly on subject. Watch this. I have no husband. This is three words in the Greek. Up until now, she's been very verbose. She's been talking. She's been firing back. Three words in the Greek. U, echo, and air. No husband. Jesus said to her, you are right when you say you have no husband. You've had five husbands. And the man you are living with now is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true. Oh, man. In this day and age, men could divorce their wives for any reason. And this woman had been married as a young woman, 13, 14, 15 years old, divorced. Married again, divorced. Married again, divorced. Married again, divorced. Married again, divorced. And then she has another man. They're not married. They're just living together. Oh, man. So Jesus just totally pressed on the pressure point, the area of her life that was the most sensitive, the most painful. He is just like a master surgeon, made an incision into her heart and just ripped this wide open, this nerve. It is just right out there exposed. Five husbands. Makes you wonder what she was thinking. You know, when you get to that point in your life, you know, in our culture, if you went through five spouses, that would be quite a lot. In this culture, this was a culture that was highly against divorce. They hated divorce. So to be picked up and used by five different men and thrown out on the street, victimized, this would be even worse. And you imagine this woman just thinking at moments throughout her life, how did my life end up like this? How did I get here? You ever feel that way? Like, how did I get to this point in my life? You know, I'm sure she was thinking to herself when she was a little kid, when I grow up, I really want to have five husbands and be treated like trash. You know, little girl. Is that what she was thinking? No way. No way. She didn't plan for this. This isn't the life that you plan for. This is the life that you're given. And so she's sitting there looking back at her life just saying, I never expected it would be this bad. Did she become self-protective? You know what that's like. You become kind of toughened, hardened, cynical, sarcastic. We pick up on a little bit of that in her interchange with Jesus. She is a little bit sarcastic, a little bit, you know, keep your distance. Cynical. Yeah, when you go through a tough life, when you go through a life that doesn't fulfill, when you have an inner thirst that just can't be quenched, eventually, you know, you try one thing and then another and then another and another, and it never quite satisfies. You constantly feel like there's got to be something more. You know, I've got it all. I've got the apartment. I've got the car. I've got the grades. I got the girlfriend, boyfriend. I got that. Something's missing. What is it? And so you become a little bit cynical. You start to, pull back. Cynicism. Just totally pervasive throughout our culture. Because it is, in one sense, very good for us to be cynical. Because if you never hope, then your hope is never disappointed. If you never trust people, your trust can never be broken. No one can ever let you down. You know, if your dad is saying, I'm going to pick you up from practice, and you trust that he's going to show up and he never does, and you got to walk home, you're wrecked. But if you say, I can't trust him, I got to figure it out on my own, you become toughened, and yes, it protects you in one sense, but it makes you hardened in another. It creates kind of a shield from pain, but it shields you from love as well. Because you can't have hope, you can't have trust, you can't have love. And so it leads to a self-protective bubble. Was it hard for her to break this cycle? You know, I'm sure after the first divorce, she thought that must have been a fluke. You know, Jewish men could divorce their wives for any reason, according to the school of Hillel. So maybe she thought that was just the guy. Maybe the guy just, you know, kicked me out. But then by the second, she's probably thinking, there's something wrong. Third, fourth, fifth, there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with this world, with this system of values in this culture. There's something wrong here. Why can't I live happily ever after? Why can't everything work out is there hope for this gnawing of the soul, the emptiness of the heart? She's not alone. I'm sure as we are thinking through this together, you can identify for the ways in which she's feeling. Julian Baggini, he's an atheistic philosopher, one of my favorites, very honest, very forthright. He says in his book on atheism, a very short introduction, in developed Western countries, we have access to more and better sources of pleasure than our predecessors could have ever imagined. Oh yeah, I've been doing a research project on anthropology, and you start to study what the ancients were like. Oh man, I mean, you compare that to our lives today, where we're so pampered and so insulated from anything ever going wrong. You know, the temperature is set to the right degree. We always have food. We've got everything. We've got everything we need. Not to ignore the entertainment, the stimulation, the drugs, everything else we've got. Yeah, we've got so much pleasure. Yet, Baggini writes, we are not a noticeably fulfilled bunch. In a world, the Western world, the United States, which is the richest culture to have ever lived, that even people in our culture who are mildly poor live better than the kings in ancient history, we are not fulfilled. Just a little bit more drugs, that would have done it. What about a little bit more advancement in my career? Then I'd be happy. Oh, if I found the right spouse, the right house, the right retirement plan, the right friend group, the right grade, and eventually if I just got into the right, that would be the thing that would fulfill us. I hope you experience this for your own sake. To reach it all the way to the top, to have all your dreams fulfilled, and then realize there's nothing on the other side. There's nothing there. The whole project is totally vacuous, empty. We read from Viktor Frankl. He was a man who survived the Holocaust and became a psychotherapist. He developed this system of therapy called logotherapy. It comes from the Greek word logos, meaning logic. That your life needs a purpose. And if your life has a purpose, you could go through a whole lot. You could survive the Holocaust, concentration camps. Of course, I would never have the temerity to say such a thing. This is Frankl's theory. And he lived through the concentration camps. This is his theory. And he writes this in his book, Man's Search for Meaning. Such widespread phenomena as depression, aggression, and addiction are not understandable. Pause. We can't even begin to understand these things. Wow. Unless what? Unless we recognize the existential vacuum underlying them. Why do I matter? Where am I going? What does it all mean? Why do I exist? Would it have mattered if I existed at all? The existential vacuum. There is no reason for my existence. He writes, people have enough to live by, but nothing to live for. That's a great line. They have the means, but no meaning. So true. You see this in celebrities. I get depressed all the time. I feel isolated. I wouldn't wish this upon anyone. Fame is so alienating. Why do I think there's still something greater out there for me? It doesn't fill your soul. I still feel empty inside. I'd be very happy if I could just cut it off, just enjoy my life when I wasn't performing. I'm kind of going through a meltdown about being famous. I'm not going to find peace with it. Okay, talk to all the people that have been there. Way more successful, way more beautiful, and rich and everything else than us, and yet we think, oh, just another promotion, another good grade, another person that likes me, all of a sudden then things would go really well. Okay, take this all the way to the extreme, it doesn't help at all. Came across this guy, he's one of the greatest climbers, and he has a YouTube channel. His name is Magnus, and he had this YouTube channel, and he's capturing the moment where his subscribers move from 999,999 over to a million. And this is what we see here.
But it's soon gonna be above a million. it's like so quiet. So we're currently in the hotel room in Czechia. Oh! Thank you.
How does it feel to have 1 million subscribers?
It feels a little bit strange. I mean, I've been so close to a million for a while now. And to people who ask me, like, I say I have a million, but now I actually have 1,000,002 subscribers. I don't know. It feels kind of empty at the same time. Because now I don't know what's the next goal. Like, 10 million seems impossible. Like, I don't say that to be humble. I say that because I actually mean that. I mean, I'm just really happy with 1 million. So, do a refresh chat. Det är liksom blandat känslor för det är sån här nu har du mått att känna det nu ja vad är nästa liksom om du får träna vidare så kan jag göra som Kristina.
I looked at this today and he had 2 million followers. I bet he feels a lot better. Yeah, I bet that solved it. 5 husbands. I wonder if she had 6 husbands if that would have done it. Well, this woman is very verbally fluent, very quick on her feet. Jesus hits at the greatest pain of her life. And she comes back and she says, "Sir, I can see that you are a prophet." Oh yeah. This was before Facebook stalking when you could check on people and stuff. He's new in town. I just saw him walk in. I didn't know where he came from. And yet he knows he got the number right. 5. And then he knows I'm living with the man, but he's not my husband. "I can see that you're a prophet, but check this out. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is on that mountain in Jerusalem." That's what we call a red herring in philosophy. That's where you drag a stinky fish across the trail to get the dogs to go that way, when really everyone else is going the other way. So you kind of do one of these over here, and then people get off the track. So he's getting deeply personal with this woman, and all of a sudden she wants to get very theological. All of a sudden she's a theologian, and she wants to talk about theology. Oh, yeah, yeah. Don't talk about me. Let's talk about this ancient debate over here. Jesus replied, look at this. "Believe me, dear woman, the time is coming when it will no longer matter whether you worship the Father on this mountain or in Jerusalem. You Samaritans know very little about the one you worship, while we Jews know all about him. For salvation comes through the Jews." To paraphrase this in a word, Jesus is saying, why are we talking about this in-house, intramural, theological debate among theologians between the Samaritans and the Jews? It doesn't even matter, which is interesting because Jesus is a rabbi. What do you mean the temple doesn't matter? You're a rabbi. And then Jesus is explicitly saying, by the way, you're wrong. Okay, so the debate is going on, yes, and we shouldn't even talk about that, yes, it doesn't really matter, yes. Also, you're wrong about that. You know very little, and salvation is from the Jews. The Samaritans were not in the right. They were wrong. This whole idea that Jesus just, you know, is just so warm and fuzzy and everything is okay with Jesus. No, he's like, that's just not true. That's not real. So he says, a time is coming, and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For they are the kind of worshipers that the Father seeks. God is spirit. He's a spiritual being, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth. In the context of speaking about a temple, temples are demarcated places where you only worship inside this little temple, but not outside. But Jesus is saying God is spirit. He's immaterial. He's omnipresent. So to worship in spirit means you worship everywhere. Not that mountain, not this mountain, not that holy place, or this holy place. And in truth means you actually have to come to God based on what's true. You can't invent a religion like the Samaritans. That was wrong. But what you can do is come to God the way that he has revealed. Jesus will later say, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." The woman said, well, it's their last ditch effort to get off the subject. She just hates talking about religion. Oh, hate this. He's getting too personal. "I know the Messiah is coming, the one who is called Christ." Oh, she blew it right there, didn't she? Trying to get off the subject, she's getting on the subject. "When the Messiah comes, the Messiah will explain everything to us. Jesus told her, lady, I am the Messiah." And right at that moment, that woman's jaw must have hit the floor. He's not just the prophet. No wonder he could know all this. And all of a sudden, the face is getting flushed. The blood pressure is increasing. And you think right at this moment, she's going to trust in Christ. Just then his disciples returned and were surprised to find him talking with a woman. Get out of here. We're having a spiritual conversation. You blew it. No spiritual radar whatsoever. All they're surprised about is you're talking to a girl. Why would you do that? So they don't like that. It makes you think, by the way, why did Jesus send all of these disciples away, 12 guys, to get 13 guys food? He didn't want them around. He wanted to talk to this woman all alone. They would have totally botched this conversation. But they come back right at the moment. The woman left her water jar beside the well. Whoa, she came all the way down there to fill up that water jar. But then she leaves it right there. And ran back to the village, and she told everyone, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Do you see what that's saying? The very area that was the greatest source of pain in her life now becomes the thing that she's shouting from the rooftops to all of the men in the city. Could he be the Messiah? You can sense a ring of hope in her voice, can't you? Could it be? Like, she hasn't been through a bunch of evidences for who Jesus is. She just met him, right? But she has that sense of, boy, could this be true? Like, I've been looking to men to get my identity. I've been looking to marriage to get a sense of self and to get that thirst quenched. But now I'm looking at the one who actually can quench the thirst. Could it be true? They came out of the town, the Samaritans, that is, and made their way toward Jesus. Meanwhile, his disciples urged Jesus, Rabbi, we brought the food, eat something. And Jesus said to them, I have food to eat that you know nothing about. But his disciples said to each other, could someone else have brought him some food? Did somebody, like, we brought the Wendy's, did they bring the BK? My food, Jesus said, is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. What you just saw, where I was weary and tired and walked 40 miles and it was in the noonday sun. That was the thing that filled me up way more than the food could have. I tell you this, open up your eyes and look at the fields. They are ripe for harvest. And right then, many Samaritans from the village believed in Jesus because the woman had said, look, he told me everything that I did. And when they came out to see him, they begged him to stay in their village. So he stayed for 2 days, long enough for many more Samaritans to hear and believe. They said to the woman, now we believe, not just because of what you told us, but because we have heard him ourselves. Now we know that he is indeed the Savior of the world. Jesus is saying, my work is to do this right here, to have these kind of interactions with people that are hurting, broken, that need God. Oh, they need God so bad. That is the thing that keeps me going. And then he turns to his disciples and he's like, look, the fields are ripe for the harvest. And right then they look up at the fields and the Samaritans are coming over the fields to meet Jesus. Well, as we wrap up here tonight, is the message of Christ for someone like me? Many people say, I wouldn't want to become a Christian. It's just not my style. I don't know. I don't think I would fit in. Almost like it's a social club. You know what I mean? Yet this woman here doesn't fit the profile of a Christian in any way you measure it. Socially, she's an outcast. No wonder she was there at the well at high noon. The women didn't go there. She didn't have women friends. She was an outcast in her society. She was poor, no doubt, thrown out on the street 5 times in a row. Racially, she was ostracized. Religiously, ostracized. Morally, compromised. She was of a different gender in a patriarchal society. She didn't check any of the boxes. And yet, this is the woman who comes to faith in Jesus. I can resonate with that, yeah. If you had told me before I came to faith in Jesus, you are going to want to have Jesus Christ lead your life. I'd be like, I don't even know what that means. You're going to go to like Bible studies and you're going to want to love and serve other people. And you're going to want to do it multiple nights a week. I would have either laughed or spit in your face. That whole idea would just be so noxious. Oh my God. Being around Christians? You mean like Bible believing Christians? Yeah. And then, by the way, you're going to want to teach the Bible. You're actually going to enjoy it. You're going to like to do it. I would have been like, get out of my face. Like, no way. And I'm sure if we went around and talked to people that have decided to come to know Christ, you'd feel the same way. That feeling of me? Not me. Could have never been me. No way. That's how you should feel, because the Spirit blows where he wishes. Remember John 3? Why me? I don't know. Can God really quench my thirst? No. If you're the kind of person that feels like you've got it all together, you don't have any need, you don't want God in your life, you just feel like, no, everything's just fine. No, no problems, no thirst. Then God's like, I've got nothing for you. It isn't that you aren't deeply in need. You are. It isn't that you aren't totally at the mercy of God. You certainly are. It's just that a person who shows up before God in a proud state, saying that I don't need you, I don't want anything, what's the point? I don't even feel like I need anything in my life. That's the person to whom God says, I have nothing for you. It isn't until your need is revealed, like this woman. Go get your husband. I don't have a husband. That's right. You had five husbands. Once you see that your life isn't working out the way that you wanted it to, that it's fundamentally bankrupt, there's something going wrong, that is at the moment where God can come into your life in a very strong way. So you might be here saying, you know, I've been depressed. I can't figure it out. I don't know what's wrong. You are not far. In fact, you are very close. Just turning to God and saying, I want you to come into my life. I want that living water. I want the death of Jesus, the Spirit of God to come into my life. I want that all to be paid for. Yeah, at that point, yeah, he can quench your thirst, to be sure. You just got to show that you need it. Well, there's other people who say, well, I've done that. I've invited Christ into my life, and I'm still not satisfied. In fact, it feels pretty mundane. Boring. Yeah, that's the right word, boring. Following Christ, very boring. Well, I don't know who you're following, but it isn't Christ. Because the Christian life is many things. I'll tell you what it ain't. It ain't boring. To be a follower of Jesus means that you take the view of the disciples that Jesus was trying to teach them, and he's trying to teach you. The view is that you look at the Samaritans, people that you have profiled, and said, no, not them. They would never come to Christ. Oh, no, not them. She's got it all together. He's got problems. He wouldn't be it. No, they're not in it. You've made up all these excuses for these people in your life saying they don't need, that's what you're saying. They don't need God. And when you get into this for weeks or months at a time where you're never sharing about this incredible message of love with other people, yeah, it gets pretty boring. Why? Because you're just living off of sandwiches. You're living off the food the disciples had. Jesus says, I've got food you don't know anything about. So merely the act of moving into someone's life and sharing about this love and forgiveness of Jesus, you wouldn't believe the spiritual life that surges back into your heart. If you're sitting around saying, oh man, I just don't feel like I'm getting anything out of this anymore. I used to have a time in my life where things were real exciting, real fun. I'm reading the Bible. I just don't get anything out of it. I pray. I feel like I'm talking to the ceiling. I'm around other Christians. It just feels like, what's the point? I would bet you you're missing this, that you haven't taken a risk lately to share about this incredible love and forgiveness with somebody else. When you do that, merely the act of doing that, sharing about this, you will see that all of a sudden you understand the thirst that you have gets quenched when you get into the same work that Jesus Christ was into. Very exciting, very happy. Even when you fail, doesn't even matter. Even when the person's like, I don't want anything to do with that. It's like, well, whatever. Make, for some reason, God fills your soul in a palpable way. Well, some people could be saying, well, could God use someone like me? I mean, Jesus, he's the master here. Of course, he could talk to this woman, not someone like me. Oh, no. You're missing it. You're missing it. Jesus isn't the focus here entirely. The woman goes and leads her entire town to Christ. Who is this woman? Very theologically adept, right? Really well respected, very popular, very attractive, very intellectual. I had a lot of love in her heart. None of that. At least the text doesn't say that. All she knew was that Jesus came into my life and he revealed to me that I am more sinful than I ever thought, but I am more loved than I ever dared hope. And she shared that with the people in the town, and they were like, we've got to meet this guy. So could God use someone like me, someone like you? Of course he can. It doesn't matter where you've been, your past. Oh, my past hasn't been that good. We're not thinking about the past, forgetting what lies behind, reaching forward to what lies ahead. You start to see that your future is very bright. If you turn to God like this woman, he's got a whole adventurous life for you set out that you can experience.